You know, after hearing about those wasps, which, you know, obviously are probably not coming to a Whole Foods near you anytime soon, I'd still bet there are plenty of listeners who were perfectly comfortable with that story. And some who'd really rather not. Chris Ying is one of the founders of the food magazine Lucky Peach and is the editor of an essay collection called You and I Eat the Same. So I asked him, really? You think?
Well, you and I don't eat the same, right? That's the truth of the matter. On our day-to-day experience, what you had for lunch today, what I had for lunch today, they're very different. What you grew up eating is different from what I grew up eating. Although I would wager that what you and I grew up eating is pretty similar.
Probably.
But in general, difference is important. Difference is everything. It creates identity. It creates pride, economic opportunity for people, especially when it comes to food. But this book's title, You and I Eat the Same, was this hypothesis, this question I had that was, how do we bridge these divides with the other side of the political spectrum or the cultural spectrum, people who I don't agree with? Mm. How do I speak to them? And the answer to me was not dwelling in difference, was to try to find some kind of common ground. And we came up with this book title. I called it You and I Eat the Same before the book was done, before I had any idea whether or not this hypothesis would be proven out. But it was sheerly because I wanted to have a statement that united us rather than trying to point out our differences.
But I want to get into the pros and cons, I guess, of believing in that statement, You and I Eat the Same. Because, you know, there are nuances, right? And it goes beyond all rose-tinted glasses, like, oh, we're all alike. And then the other side of it, which is, ew, no, what you eat is disgusting. I hate you. There's a lot of room in between those poles, right? So let's get into some of the things in the book. One of the things I was really excited to read was Tianlan Ho's piece about how sesame is actually pretty close to being like a universal ingredient. It's totally central to many Chinese cuisines, Japanese cuisine, Syrian cuisine, Lebanese cuisine, Israeli cuisine, and it's on McDonald's buns, right? It's on the Big Mac buns. So there are ways in which we do eat the same and we don't even know it.
That's right. I mean, I love this exercise. You know, when you first started talking about sesame, I wonder what your listeners' minds drifted to, the first dish that people thought of when you said sesame. And chances are, you know, it had to do with the last thing they ate that had sesame on it, or the thing they grew up eating with sesame on it. For me, you know, growing up Chinese American, my mind goes to the same things that the writer of that piece, Tian Lun's, mind went to too. It goes to tang yuan, you know, these sesame filled glutinous rice balls. I think that I'm probably in the, you know, for lack of a better word, minority in thinking of that. But sesame comes from Africa. And I like to think about these ingredients as having some sort of consciousness almost. They're so successful. They're like, they adapt wherever they go. They're so useful for so many different culinary purposes. We plant them wherever we can. People buy them all over the world. And that species has propagated because it's succeeded everywhere. But wherever it is, you know, people will say like, oh, I feel like sesame is our flavor. Sesame belongs to us. And like you said, like you rightly pointed out, Americans eating at McDonald's will have a sesame seed bun every day. And in some senses, like it feels very American in that way, the sesame seed bun. And so all of those differences and the different ways that sesame is applied are so important. But maybe recognizing that layer underneath that, hey, this is the same thing, and we're all eating it in different ways. You know, as different as we might seem, there's some commonality here. And if we're going to try to bridge these gaps between us, the way that's going to happen, I think, is to speak from some place of common ground, to speak to one another's priorities and values.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, because sesame, tahina, hummus, you know, there's a connected dots there. And in my head, I'm remembering this Israeli chef I met once who wants to write this book, like the magnum opus of the chickpea, and talk about all the ways that chickpea and hummus are important to him as an Israeli, but also important to all the cultures of the Middle East. And, you know, this is a region where obviously there's a lot of strife, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of conflict. And he's like, look, we all eat chickpeas.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's so much crossover and mixing and melding of flavors and ingredients in that region because there is so much similarity in origin and background. And in Tian Lun's piece about sesame, she points to this interesting example of, you know, some of the best tahini factories are Palestinian run. And but that ingredient is so important to Israelis. Like, they have brokered a way in which the rabbis can monitor the factories to make sure everything is kosher. And then they have special permits that allow the delivery trucks to travel across the West Bank. And it's like, it's incredible. Like, given as much conflict as there is there, this ingredient, this taste, this flavor is so important. Like, we can make peace for that. Like, we can't make peace for other things. But, like, let's at least make a little temporary peace for good tahini.
Yeah. It's also, I don't know, like, yeah, like you said, like, I don't want to get too much into the geopolitics of it because I'm dumb and don't know anything about it. But, like, a lot of conflicts are political and they're at the level of the government and they're at the level of political leadership. And on a daily person level, it's like, look, I love the tahina. I just want to be able to eat it. I want you to be able to make it. I want to be able to pay you money for it. Like, come on.
Yes. And that's so relevant here, too, isn't it, Francis? Like, a lot of these arguments about immigration, border security, they're happening in the abstract in terms of politics when, you know, I think that regardless of which side of the political spectrum you're on, your day-to-day experience of other people, of immigrants, isn't defined by what you're hearing in the political arena. It's defined by your day-to-day experience of it, like the people that you run into, the foods that you eat. And again, I'm not trying to look at this with rose-colored glasses and say, you know, we eat Mexican food and therefore we can, you know, all agree that we should have open borders with Mexico. Like, that's not what I'm saying at all, but I'm just saying we should try to dwell in commonality in order to have constructive conversations.
Mm. Well, okay, there's another side of it too, though, right? There's another piece in the book by Osai Endelin, and her article is about fried chicken. And my understanding of what she was saying in that article is that in some ways saying we all eat the same can be a problem, right? Because in her essay, it's like, yeah, everyone loves fried chicken. I love fried chicken. You love fried chicken. People around the world fried chicken. But then to just flatten it out and say, hey, everyone loves fried chicken is to ignore the fact that in the United States, for a huge part of our history, frying chicken was something that Black people did largely for other people, and their specific history is ignored. You know, no one can say who invented it, but it was produced in Black kitchens for commercial clientele, largely white clientele, for a really long time. And, you know, if it's like, oh, well, everyone loves it, everyone eats it, then, like, that history is ignored, and those people don't get credit. If anything, it's turned into this gross stereotype about Black people, you know, love and eat fried chicken.
Yes. Yeah. The problem and the difficulty with the conversation that we're having in food media here, and by and large, this conversation is happening largely in food media and not at your average dinner table, about cultural appropriation, or what Krishnendu Rey calls in this book culinary misappropriation, is that people want defined rules. The people who are trying to cook food that was originated with somebody else want to know what's off limits. They want to know how to do it right. And those who feel ownership over it can't necessarily provide those rules. When it comes to fried chicken, we do have to make special dispensation in this kind of idea of togetherness and unity and sharing of ingredients and ideas for people, for African Americans specifically, whose history and contributions to the culinary canon in America have been systematically erased and minimized and trampled over. And that piece that she's writing about is not just sort of shaking her fist and saying that. It's sure. saying that we all like fried chicken, vegetarians notwithstanding. So if we can all agree on that, can we also agree to share some of the weight of its history? That piece starts with a guy named Morgan McGlone, and Morgan runs a hot chicken shop in, or several hot chicken shops in Australia. And he's a half Maori, half Irish guy cooking hot chicken, which is, you know, a subspecies of fried chicken invented in Nashville, halfway across the world. And he's serving it to people who, by and large, have no idea about the history of fried chicken. And to know Morgan is to know, like, just one of the most generous and kind and thoughtful people cooking food. And when I think of him and when I talk to Osai about him, I was just kind of like, what can we just use him as a case study? Can we think about a person that we really like and respect, but who's doing something that we're not entirely sure is okay? Can you just serve Nashville hot chicken without the context, without the culinary history halfway around the world? Mm-hmm. And there's no straightforward answer. And there's no way for me to say, like, you're allowed to do this. You're allowed to serve Nashville hot chicken anywhere you want, so long as you're a nice guy who speaks four languages and I know not to be racist. Like, that's just, like, patently not possible, unless people want to make me, like, a cool judge of that sort. Like, I'll take that job. But that's why it's complicated. And just trying to know and trying to, like, ask the questions and have the conversations is the best that I've got so far. Like, that's as far as I can take it. And having these conversations is as good as I can do for now.
Yeah. No easy answers.
Exactly.
So life's big questions. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Ying is the editor of the book You and I Eat the Same. And, you know, I think about the thing he brings up at the end of that interview a lot, because people get really, really upset if they ever think anyone is trying to tell them what they, quote-unquote, are allowed to cook. And yes, of course you can cook tapas if you're Irish, and French food if you're Japanese, and hey, you know, most of the line cooks at that very nice Italian restaurant you went to last week are probably Guatemalan. But the question is, if you're selling and making money with the food of the people who've been historically looked down upon, are you doing it in a way that helps uplift people? Like, maybe people who were raised in that culture and that helps them tell their own stories? I mean, like Chris said, no one asked me to judge, right? But I think we can all agree that we should be thanking and honoring the people who've taught us and inspired us, right? In the end, I think it's really just about respect and good faith. And anyway, if you listen to that interview and really just want recipes for some sesame, check out splendidtable.org. There are literally hundreds of recipes that use sesame, like Nigella Lawson's butterfly chicken with miso and sesame seeds.